Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Greetings out there to our War Room podcast audience. This is Jackie Witt. I'm Professor of Strategy and the War Room podcast editor at the Army War College. Thanks for joining us today for another episode. As you know, you can find previous episodes of the podcast and all of the essays published on the War Room online at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. There you'll find contemporary, relevant, and insightful analysis about a wide variety of issues related to war, defense, security, and strategy. On today's podcast, we bring you another discussion about global and regional security, this time focusing our lens on the U.S. role in Asia, and specifically looking at the U.S. alliance with Japan. As you well know, the relationship has not always been a friendly one, and even after the end of World War II, when the pair entered a formal alliance and millions upon millions of dollars of aid poured into Japan to rebuild it, economic competition continued to shape the relationship. And so today, Japan is a critical partner and ally for the U.S. in the Asia-Pacific region, but challenges and opportunities remain. Here to discuss these important issues, I'm pleased to have Mr. Ray Green, who's a State Department Foreign Service Officer and Asia Hand, currently on the faculty at the U.S. Army War College, and Lieutenant General retired Chip Gregson, who is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia-Pacific Security Affairs, Commander of the U.S. Marine Forces Pacific, and Commanding General of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force in Okinawa, Japan. So let's turn now to their discussion.
Good morning. This is Ray Green. I'm happy to be here today with Lieutenant General retired Wallace Chip Gregson. We've worked together for many years together, so it's a special pleasure for me to welcome you, Chip, up here to Carlisle, to the War College, and thank you so much for sitting down and talking to us here at War Room.
Well, thank you. It's great to see you too, Ray, especially on this side of the ocean.
Well, it's very timely to have you up here to speak to War Room, given all of the recent events in the region, especially with North Korea. I saw President Trump in his State of the Union address the other night devoted considerable attention to the threat that's posed by North Korea. So I was hoping to maybe start by asking you, do you see North Korea's development of ICBM capabilities, nuclear-capable ICBMs, as changing the fundamental dynamics in the relationship? And what do you see as North Korea's longer-term endgame?
North Korea has fundamentally changed the status quo in the region with their missile program and the success of their nuclear program. The dynamics of this, their goal is at least regime survival. Mm-hmm. It's at least includes coercion, but more dangerously, I think that it's a drive of North Korea for major power status and unification of the peninsula on North Korea's terms.
Mm-hmm. We've seen some recent outreach from the North Koreans to the Moon administration in South Korea. Obviously, we have the Olympics coming up with a North and South Korean having combined delegations or our teams. Should we be concerned about alliance unity, given all of the fissures that we see the North Koreans trying to drive between our alliances in Northeast Asia?
The Olympics gambit is one example, but I think it's a rather small example. I think that we need to be concerned about alliance cohesion, alliance mm-hmm. unity overall. I think that the biggest danger of this gambit by North Korea is that they have the potential to damage or, in fact, destroy our alliances with the Republic of Korea and Japan.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see the role of China? Obviously, successive administrations have put a lot of hope that China would be able to use its influence, economic and diplomatic influence, to try to rein in North Korea or at least slow down their program. Mm-hmm. Do you think they've done all they can do? Do you think we should expect that they can apply more pressure, or should we look in other directions?
Well, they haven't done all they can do, but I think they've done pretty much everything they will do. China's got its own interests with North Korea. Mm-hmm. China's got its own set of lousy options on dealing with North Korea. They're not happy with North Korea mm-hmm. either, but that does not mean that their interests coincide with ours. They want an entity like North Korea on their border. They do not want a democracy on their border like mm-hmm. the United States or the Republic of Korea. And should collapse occur in North Korea for one reason or another, China will intervene very, very heavily in support of their own interests, mm-hmm. even if not in support of North Korea.
Hmm. Do you think there's any room for the U.S. and China to talk about things like collapse scenarios? I know it's very sensitive for the Chinese, given their longstanding relationship with North Korea.
In the past, whenever we've approached, to my knowledge, whenever we've approached the Chinese about discussing collapse scenarios and perhaps deconfliction action to keep Americans and Chinese from inadvertently running into each other, they refuse to even consider it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason is, and there's some truth to this, that we'll leak it,
mm-hmm.
which then will create problems with the rest of the things they're trying to do with North Korea.
Right. How do you see the broader U.S.-China relationship? The recent national security strategy had quite a significant shift in some of the terminology used and also the scope of our competition with the Chinese, a little bit less focus on the cooperative elements of the relationship.
Well, going back to the days of Deng Xiaoping, mm-hmm. when China decided to get back into the economic world with the rest of us, we have felt that it was better to help China reintegrate into the international order than leave China isolated, angry, and upset. We championed their entry into the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. We've done other things that are hardly unfriendly acts. China's recent activities indicate that while that may have been the right idea at the time, that it's run its course, mm-hmm. and that we have now a different relationship with China. I was glad to see the national security strategy and a national defense strategy recognize that we have a strategic competition with China.
Right.
That doesn't mean breaking diplomatic relations. That doesn't mean creating a hostile atmosphere. But it does mean that we're negotiating from a different position, and we understand that in the economic arena, in the diplomatic arena, and in the military arena, we are in a competition.
Mm-hmm. One area that obviously is kind of at the forefront of that competition is the South China Sea. Recently, we had the most recent round of FONOPS, Freedom of Navigation Operations. Do you think we're doing enough to address that issue, or are there other avenues we should be exploring in order to try to slow down Chinese militarization of the area?
I don't know that there's anything we can do that would directly that would slow down the Chinese militarization, mm-hmm. of the features they've built and claimed. China, including their leadership, Xi Jinping on down, have adopted this mantra of undisputed historical sovereignty. This eliminates any possibility for the Chinese to do any compromise on any issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this situation where they have de facto control over the South China Sea now. We challenge it with freedom of navigation operations and things, but we have to do more. But we're going to have to do more asymmetrically, mm-hmm. rather than symmetrically in the South China Sea.
Right. One of the kind of the side effects of China's strategy in South China seems to be driving other countries to harden their policies towards China, or at least look for ways to hedge against China. Does this open up opportunities for the U.S. to expand the relationship among our partners?
I think we should work very hard to expand our relationships with Vietnam and the Philippines, mm-hmm. as two high priorities, since they have the vast majority of the coastlines on the South China Sea. I also think we need to do more with Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Our ally Japan does a lot of investment and aid with Vietnam and the Philippines because they have a pretty identical geostrategic view of what's happening in, mm-hmm. the South China Sea to what we do. Yes, we need to do more, and that's part of the asymmetric things that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. that I envision that we would have to do to make sure that we challenge what China's doing here.
Right. There's been some concerns in the region, particularly after the U.S. withdrew from the TPP, about kind of the sustainability of the U.S. Commitment to our partners. Do you think there's a concern about, I wouldn't say abandonment, but maybe countries will start hedging their bets if they see us as potentially weakening our resolve?
I think many countries are already hedging their bets. President Duterte in the Philippines, mm-hmm. Is certainly trying to play both sides against the middle here. The ASEAN nations are, particularly Cambodia, are moving away from the U.S. and leaning toward China. We need to do more in many areas, mm-hmm. and in my opinion, dropping out, canceling, abandoning our own effort with the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a terrific own goal.
Mm-hmm. Right. What about India? We recently had this the reconstitution of the Quad process in Manila. Do you see that as a in the Indo-Pacific formulation used in national security strategy? How do you see India-U.S. relations evolving, and how can they play into our East Asia strategy?
I think that we need to work with India where we can. I mm-hmm. think that it's unrealistic to consider India as an ally. They are, by the way, the creators of the non-aligned movement. Mm-hmm. They take non-alignment seriously. We need to recognize that, but that does not mean that we cannot pursue together efforts where they fall within the national interest of both nations.
Mm-hmm. One area that I know India has expressed a lot of concern about recently is China's Belt and Road Initiative, seeing it as perhaps a geostrategic challenge and an effort by China to extend its influence in where India's traditional, self-defined sphere of influence. How do you think the United States should respond to the BRI, and should we cooperate, compete, ignore?
Even before we get to the BRI, there was a thing called the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Right.
And much more than the U.S. not joining the AIIB, we encouraged our allies to defer joining the AIIB, mm-hmm. very unsuccessfully, I might mm-hmm. add. The Belt and Road Initiative is certainly a geo-economic effort on the part of China to extend influence. It's interesting that the capitalist nations of the world, the United States in particular, are not championing our own instruments of investment here, where mm-hmm. the deal is much fairer and much more to the benefit of the receiving country than is the Chinese style of giving loans to have a country pay for Chinese laborers to come mm-hmm. in there and build things, and the country gets indebted to China, and China gets to expand its influence that way. The United States used to be good at waging ideological competition, mm-hmm. and we need to get back to being able to do that.
Right. So you would counsel maybe a more competitive approach to the initiative?
I think that with what's happening now with the TPP-11, mm-hmm. With Japan in the lead, that we need to pay attention to this. Our allies want it. Mm-hmm. Our friends want it. It's a way for defending the international order that has done so much since the end of World War II to raise hundreds of millions from poverty and to defeat the Soviet Union without another major conflict. Mm-hmm. What's at risk now is China changing the status quo.
Right. You mentioned there are U.S.-Japan alliance. I know over the years you've contributed a lot to the development and evolution of that alliance, and it seems to be in pretty strong shape right now, particularly given the very strong relations between Prime Minister Abe and President Trump and the revision of our guidelines. How do you see that relationship going in the future, and how do you see that relationship fitting into our broader hub-and-spoke network of alliances?
I think China's made terrific progress since about 2011 on all the things that we have talked to them about for these many years, mm-hmm. on improving their defensive posture, improving their security posture. I think what remains to be done on that side, just when you're talking about the forces, is that we need to be able to become more joint and more combined mm-hmm. with our alliance forces. We have to fight as one force. We can't fight as two separate forces if the worst comes to the worst. In this way, by merely improving our ability to work together, we automatically enhance our deterrence. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think the alliance has to continue to strengthen in areas that are not military. We need cultural exchanges, we need education exchanges, mm-hmm. Co-development, research projects, technical research, all these things to continue to strengthen those parts of the alliance that are part of national life other than just the military.
Right. Maybe focus a little bit more on the military. The realignment of our forces, not just in Japan, but the laydown in the Western mm-hmm. Pacific, do you think that's moving along smoothly? Do you think there needs to be any further refinements of that plan in order to meet our strategic and political needs?
Smoothly is not a word often applied to the realignment efforts. The part dealing with the base buildup in Guam mm-hmm. and the additional American forces in Guam, I think it needs to be emphasized that within the agreements, we say that the U.S. will provide for the continuous presence and the training of Japanese forces in Guam mm-hmm. and the Commonwealth of the Marianas and the Compact States, et cetera. Mm-hmm. This would be a terrific way to extend the reach of the alliance into that area of the Pacific, and also a great way to train U.S. and Japanese forces to be able to integrate across air, land, and sea, and articulate maneuver, and incorporate space, cyberspace, undersea, and all these things. Secondly, the realignment in Japan, the movement replacement of Futenma, of course, continues to be moving forward with all deliberate political speed, shall we say. Progress is being made, but we're all familiar with the situation. The other thing to do is look at, if we're going to draw the alliance closer, then we need to question the existence of U.S. and Japanese bases separately in Japan. It's not really separate because we have many bases that host both U.S. and Japanese forces, one of which, the jewel in the crown, is Marine Corps Air Station Iwakuni, greatly expanded now thanks to terrific Japanese investment. Naval bases, Japanese and American ships are there together, Air Force bases, Misawa is a combined base, even in Okinawa, White Beach is combined. There's ways to put this together. The alliance is old enough now and mature enough now, and the Japanese and Americans know each other well enough now that let's not pay for the base infrastructure twice. Let's put the Japanese forces and the American forces together, which, by the way, also aids interoperability.
Speaking of interoperability, I know not just Japanese forces, but also Singapore and Australia and other allies train in Guam. How do we do more of networking these alliances together and increasing interoperability on a multilateral basis?
I think Guam would be an ideal place to establish a live virtual constructive training capability like the Australians did in Townsville, like we have done in the United States in various places. And in this way, we can do high-intensity, high-quality, stressful training for commanders, their staffs, and the troops with very little expense. You don't have to put 100,000 people in the field, for example, to do this kind of thing. And ships can operate from their own home port and connect into this thing. The more we can do with this to bring allies and partners together and in practical work, the more we enhance our own capabilities, the more we enhance capabilities across alliances and potential alliances, and the more we're able to work together, and the more we set a much stronger deterrent in the theater for anybody who wishes to damage this.
Right. Well, speaking of regional security challenges, Taiwan obviously is one of the more kind of complicated challenges we have. We have our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act to help Taiwan defend itself, but given China's rapid military modernization, how do you see the best way forward for us in maintaining the cross-strait military balance, or at least deterring China from using force to resolve the issue?
Taiwan's a terrific example that Chinese can prosper under democracy. It's a vibrant society, it's productive, highly economic. But we need to realize that they're coming under increasing pressure. Xi Jinping made the famous three-plus-hour speech to the Chinese Party Congress. He drew the longest applause in that speech for his uncompromising stance on Taiwan. That's significant. President Xi later told President Trump that Taiwan, not North Korea nukes, was the most significant, most critical issue in Sino-American relations. That should also be a big signal to us on this. Xi talks about the great rejuvenation by 2049. It's a clear signal that within the next 10, 20 years, Xi plans to incorporate Taiwan. Most recently, our National Defense Authorization Act language talked about the end of self-imposed restraints on general and flag officer visits and called for reciprocal port visits. In response, Minister Li Ka-shin of the PRC Embassy in Washington told hundreds of people at an embassy event that the minute a U.S. Navy ship calls at a U.S. At a Taiwan port, China would activate its anti-secession law and unleash the People's Liberation Army. This is unacceptable. We need to work with Taiwan. We need to work with China, but we need to make absolutely clear that China understands that our vital interests are involved here, and we need to back it up.
What do you think about the proposal for reciprocal port visits?
The timing of it will be interesting, but I think it's time, especially if China continues to push on this. We need to show that we can make things uncomfortable for them too.
Right.
doesn't have to be the USS Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a minesweeper.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to make the point.
And how about in terms of Taiwan's own self-defense capabilities? It's always very political, these decisions over arms sales to Taiwan. Do you think we're giving them the capabilities they need to defend themselves? Are there other things that we could be providing to Taiwan to enable them to be able to enhance deterrence?
Giving them what they need is always a matter for interpretation, mm-hmm. but without getting into any specific weapon system, because Taiwan pays for these, it's not things that we're giving them.
Mm-hmm.
We need to continue to make sure that we help Taiwan develop its own forces and mm-hmm. to enhance their own plans for defense. This is not a helpless grape hanging off the coast. Mm-hmm. Taiwan is very defendable. The terrain in Taiwan, as you know, is either vertical or horizontal, and the horizontal terrain in turn is either urbanized or it's inundated.
Mm-hmm.
This is not good maneuver territory. There are very few assailable beaches if mm-hmm. you're talking about an invasion. The threat of bombardment is always there, but every strategic air survey that I'm aware of has mm-hmm. shown that strategic bombardment of civilian areas, civilian populations, enhances resistance rather
right.
than reducing it. Taiwan has ways to challenge attempts to conquer it militarily, and I would observe that they're in a much better position right now than Great Britain was in 1940, facing the wrath and the assembled might of the Wehrmacht
mm-hmm.
on the French coast. Hitler couldn't figure out how to get across the canal, and the situation's analogous, only the distance is greater, and Taiwan's got better defensive terrain.
That's an interesting analogy. Speaking of aerial bombardments, we've seen in the press the last couple of days discussion about a bloody nose strike against North Korea. Do you think that this is a realistic option, or are there other options we can consider in terms of containing North Korea's threats?
Since about 1994, every time North Korea has acted up with a nuclear program and a nuclear and missile program, we go through the same list of options. We consider preemptive strike.
Mm-hmm.
We consider negotiations leading to agreements, and then we finally end up at sanctions. Preemptive strike has always heretofore been considered not viable because our allies and friends would take all the damage.
Mm-hmm.
A preemptive or bloody nose strike, even if it's just one single surgical strike or whatever, presumes that A, we know where everything is that's important, B, that Kim Jong-un will understand the signal.
Mm-hmm.
I'd ask, how well did Vietnam understand the signaling we did for about 8 years with the bombings
Rolling thunder,
in North
yeah.
Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
A single preemptive strike that is not massive and fatal leaves the initiative with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
They can then decide how to respond. South Korea understands that. Japan understands that. Backing up from that a little bit, I think we need to consider what's important here. We need to worry a little bit less about North Korea and worry a lot more about protecting our allies, Japan and the Republic of Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we do, it's got to enhance the protection of Japanese and Korean interests, territory, and most importantly, lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to operate accordingly. We say all military options are on the table. The one I don't think that we've done very much about since we said that is enhancing our deterrence.
Mm-hmm.
And with North Korea's actions, we have a golden opportunity to enhance our deterrence now. For one thing, we can go to China and say, if you can't or won't help us to restrain North Korea, then we have no choice but to enhance our alliance capabilities, whether you object to that or not,
mm-hmm.
because our vital interests are engaged here, and
right.
then we need to do just that. What this would take, the easy part is, yes, enhance missile and air defense. Beyond that, what else we want to do would be very much, in my opinion, up to discussions with the Koreans and the Japanese, because our goal here is to increase the confidence of their governments and their people
mm-hmm.
in our ability to manage this problem. So enhance deterrence, double down on containment, double down on law enforcement around the region and
mm-hmm.
the world to shut down the North Korean illegal businesses
mm-hmm.
that are sustaining the Kim family crime syndicate, and work it that way. restarting an information campaign that talks about the differences between the U.S. and China, the U.S. and North Korea, gets word into the North Koreans, who have more ability to understand the rest of the world now than they used to. Maybe if we're talking directly to the North Koreans in a sense of broadcasting messages and things, that this will make life a little more uncomfortable for Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it's a good way ahead. Well, I think we're about at our time, but thanks again, General Gregson, for coming to share your views. As the Chinese like to say, we live in interesting times, and appreciate your help in helping us and our listeners understand that. So,
thank you, Ray. It's great to see you.
Yeah, look forward to having you back in Carlisle.
We'd love to come back.
Thanks.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.